The next matter is Hyde versus City of Lake Stevens.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay.
I'm Carl Lopez. I represent Steve Hyde and his wife. Steve Hyde was in training and had been hired by the Lake Stevens Police Department. During the course of his training, he was tased, suffered severe injury. So
he'd already been hired?
Yes, he had already been hired. He was going through the training. He had already been given a uniform, badge, gun, was going out on. I actually also had a commission card as well. And we also have the issue before the court is, and on summary judgment, it was dismissed based on the idea that he wasn't allowed to recover under the right to sue portion of the Luff statute. This despite the fact that the Lake Stevens have been collecting dues from his paycheck to pay for his left dues, that they were themselves paying left premiums, that they signed a request for admission admitting that left was the applicable workman's compensation law applying to Mr. Hyde's injuries. Our position is that, in fact, left should apply, that it should apply to training officers in training. He had already been hired. He was being paid full-time.
What about the court's ruling on the statute of limitations?
Well, I think the court was wrong on the statute of limitations for a couple of reasons. First of all, they should have applied the discovery rule with respect to the tasing claim. What the court found was that the claim accrued the minute he was tased and knew that he had been injured.
Why was that wrong?
That was wrong because he didn't discover that the method of tasing him was improper until he contacted Taser International and was informed that he was tased using improper technique. And there is another claim also, which clearly is within the statute of limitations, which is the issue of whether or not it was mandatory that he be tased. In fact, he was told by his training officer that he had to be tased if he wanted the job. He later found out in 2011, when the chief was deposed, that in fact he wasn't required to be tased to have the job. He didn't have to undergo tasing. The statute of limitations on that, from the discovery of the fact that he didn't have to be tased, still hasn't run. That won't run until July. And so the discovery rule ought to be applied. This being tased and the proper technique for being tased is not something that's commonly known. It's not like a rear ender or something like that. The fact of the matter is, within a couple of months after his surgery, he immediately contacted Taser International to inquire about the way he was tased and was informed that, in fact, they don't recommend people being tased the way he was tased. He filed there's all kinds of issues relating to service. For sure, Lake Stevens was properly served by the beginning of September. September 30th is when he discovered that the tasing technique was not proper. I should also interject that it's appropriate to use the discovery rule in this case because there was all sorts of discovery that took place in this case. It's not a situation where the claim grew stale. This is a situation where there was extensive discovery that took place, so there's no fear of a stale claim in this circumstance. So, in my view, both of the claims are timely. The discovery rule applies to both, and the statute of limitations was improperly decided by the trial court. The trial court felt that the statute of limitations in this case ought to begin running the minute you were tased and the minute you knew you were injured. I submit that that's not the law. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Very well.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Brenda Bannon. I'm with the law firm of Keating, Buckland, and McCormick. I represent the City of Lake Stevens in this matter. We are seeking an order affirming the order on summary judgment. I do intend to spend most of my time on the jurisdictional issue with respect to the insufficiency of process. There was no service as outlined in the statute on the appropriate statutory designee in this
case.
Well,
I don't think we're real confused about the state of the law there. what I'd like you to spend your time on is telling me what the status that this man was with the City of Lake Stevens and Visa, being a commissioned police officer or not being a commissioned police officer of the state of Washington, when this injury occurred. Was he working?
I'm happy to do so, Your Honor. The point I want to make at the outset, however, is that we need to look no further if there's no jurisdiction. So all of the substantive arguments made once you get past the jurisdictional issue.
Do you think
issue,
I missed that, counsel?
Thank
Please
you, Your Honor.
Answer my question.
Thank you. I'm happy to do so. Mr. Hyde was hired as a probationary officer with a provisional offer of employment contingent on all of the factors that are laid out in his offer letter, which include he would have to become a commissioned police officer, he would have to complete his probationary training, he would have to attend the basic law enforcement academy and complete the training there, become a commissioned officer through that particular commission, which you're all very familiar with. You've evaluated those issues most recently in that Adams case in the ENT case, Mr. Scott End. Status as of the date of the tasing in early June 2009, he'd just become come over from Florida a couple of days earlier under that provisional offer of hire. He hadn't been to the academy, obviously, and with respect to the assertion by Mr. Lopez that he'd already received a commission card, there's the declaration from the police chief that he hadn't even received the commission card from the people that provided it to him. At the time of the tasing, he hadn't sworn him in as an officer. He had not commissioned him. So he was not, under the definitions of the left statute and the WAX, a commissioned police officer. He wasn't authorized to enforce the laws under the state of Washington.
Well, he had a card, we've been told. He had a card, and he'd been hired, and he'd gone through training.
You've been told that, but what I urge the court to do is be cautious about the representations made in the briefing if it wasn't before the court at the time of the summary judgment hearing.
So there was no evidence before the court at the time of summary judgment that he had received a card?
Exactly. The evidence in front of the court at the time of the summary judgment hearing is that the card hadn't even been received from the police department. Chief Slory hadn't even received the card itself. It had his name on it as of the date of the tasing, and he had not sworn him in. And so if a card showed up later, that's a different issue. But as of the date of the tasing, it had not. And again, I caution the court to be very careful as you go through the record, because what happened in this case in appellant's briefing is that it's smattered with records that were provided to the court on motion for reconsideration. And a number of those records were actually stricken earlier and then resubmitted on reconsideration. So I would urge you to look specifically at the court order on summary judgment to see exactly what was in front of the court at that time, and also to see the order that struck the evidence that was inadmissible, which was never appealed in this matter. He was not commissioned, he was not sworn in, he was not eligible to enforce the criminal statutes in this case. But on reconsideration, he came up with all sorts of suggestions that there was contrary evidence that was never before the court before on summary judgment. So in terms of the issue that the court asked me about in terms of his left status, it's true, and Steve Eden, who is the HR manager, candidly acknowledged that as a part of the hiring process and all the forms he had him sign when he came in early June, he had him sign the form on the left application because he assumed he would be able to complete the training and go through the academy and all of that because he came to the city as a lateral officer from Florida, so he wasn't a new young hire. So he, in error, signed him up. But the truth of the matter is that as of that first couple of days of being a provisional officer, he hadn't been sworn in.
What do you mean by signed him up?
So, you know, when a person comes to a department and they're being hired, there's all sorts of application hiring forms.
So it was an application?
An application form for the DRS benefits. But according to the WAC and the statute, in order to be a member, you must be a commissioned police officer. As the court recently looked at in the Adams case, you must be a commissioned police officer to fit the definition of a law enforcement officer. So you have to be eligible to enforce the criminal laws of the state of Washington, which he was not. And if we just step back for a moment in terms of why does that make sense, this officer was a lateral hire from Florida, so he knew the laws, the statutes, and the Constitution for the state of Florida. He had not yet been trained in the statutes and Constitution and the common law in the state of Washington. He was not yet commissioned or sworn in to enforce those laws. And so he did not fit the definition for a LEF member, and he was not, therefore, eligible to sue his employer under that statute. There's a lot of argument in the appellate's briefing regarding trying to fit a square peg into a round hole here, but as we know, as a matter of statutory construction, we look at the plain language. This court has repeatedly, this division, looked at the LEF statute and applied the plain language of the definitions, even when it suggests it disagrees and suggests that we go to the legislature if you disagree with the policy here. But the definitions are plain. The language is plain. And the provision on the right to sue is unambiguous, and it doesn't contradict or conflict with any other statutory provision. There's no argument before the court that it does. What has been argued here is that you shouldn't apply it, that you should not apply the plain language of the definitions, that you should carve out some exception here for some reason that is not articulated, and that in this particular case, you should look at evidence that wasn't even before the court on summary judgment, which we know is not allowed. And there are also arguments with respect to the motion for reconsideration that have been plainly waived because there was no assignment of error to that argument. There was no assignment of error to that order. There's actually absolutely no briefing in the appellate's brief with respect to that whole procedural hearing. The arguments that were made, the ruling that the court made, the evidence that plainly can be refused on a motion for reconsideration if it wasn't provided before. There's no explanation for why it wasn't provided before. I also want to step back for a moment with respect to the issue on Mr. Lopez's assertion that there were two claims. There was only one claim made in the complaint. It was a negligence claim, pure and simple, and he asserted there was negligence in the manner that the taser instrument was used. It's a simple personal injury case. There was no articulation, no pleading of a negligent misrepresentation claim. It's not there. It's a very short complaint. You cannot find it there because it does not exist. It was raised as a new claim, a new theory of the case for the first time on motion for reconsideration. And the case law is clear. It's not an opportunity for a second bite of the apple to bring in new theories, new claims, new arguments, or new evidence. And that's exactly what Mr. Hyde tried to do at the motion for reconsideration here. So none of that is before the court. And so Mr. Lopez argues that on the negligent misrepresentation claim that statute is still running. Nothing could be further from the truth because that claim isn't even in the case. So the tasing occurred in June 2009, and the statute ran in mid-August 2012. And we alerted Mr. Lopez of all of that information within a month of us receiving
All of what information?
With respect to going back to what we believe is the crux of the case, the failure of service of process. So we received the complaint in December 2010. In January 2011, we answer. We not only assert the defense of insufficiency of process, but we also specifically deny that the court has jurisdiction. And whenever we were asked in discovery, we reasserted that fact. And not only that, but we pointed out at every turn when we were asked that he was not commissioned, that he was probationary, that we had immunity under the Industrial Insurance Act. And our first argument out of the bat when we filed our motion for summary judgment was that there was no jurisdiction. And then we went as our next argument that this was not a commissioned police officer entitled to sue his employer because he was not, as defined, a law enforcement officer. Thank you for your patience, and we ask you to affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to reconsideration, I will simply point out that, in fact, a new issue was raised at the response to summary judgments, which is why we raised some new issues on reconsideration, and the court did not strike any of our declarations that we submitted on reconsideration. So, you know, the thing that, you know, as I was looking back through things, I was kind of puzzled that I actually didn't highlight more of the case of Locke versus the City of Seattle. It is in my briefing, but it's actually very similar to the case we have here. We had a firefighter in training. The City of Seattle tried to argue that Leff shouldn't apply because he's in training. He's not a firefighter under the statute. And the Supreme Court disagreed. Many of the same kind of facts as we presented here, where the city had signed him up for Leff, where there was, I believe, premiums paid. I believe that there were, and he was allowed to recover under the Leff statute. There is an implication.
You cited that case in your.
I did cite the brief, but I don't think I went through the facts as thoroughly as I should have. It's factually very similar, and frankly, with this, so clearly firemen in training, before they're full-fledged firemen, can sue under Leff statute. What Lake Stevens is arguing is there ought to be a different thing for policemen in training, and I simply submit that doesn't make sense. There are reasons why the police and firemen are allowed to bring tort claims. And it relates to the danger of what they do, including the fact that they have to go through training that can be dangerous. And there is it's being advocated that there be a strict definition of what a member is before the person can be allowed to sue. That doesn't make sense. If, in fact, the statute is there to allow people to sue because of the dangerous nature of the work, then, in fact, that's not different because you happen to be a trainee as opposed to being a formally commissioned police officer. The fact assertions that I've made, we've cited to the record. We have not asserted any facts that are not cited to the record. I think it's not only reasonable, but it would be inconsistent to allow firefighters in training to bring lawsuits under the Leff statute, while at the same time denying police officers who are in at least as probably as dangerous a profession, denying them that right. I don't think that distinction makes a difference. I think the Supreme Court has addressed the fact that formality is not a requirement. Formal adherence to the definition of what a law enforcement officer is or a firefighter is not a requirement before you're allowed to bring an action under the Leff statute. That's all I have.
Thank you, counsel.